Well, thank you, Mohan, and it's a pleasure to be here. When I was communicating with Mohan, I very cutely said I might be able to talk about honey for ghost viruses, and next thing you know, it's in the title of a talk. So probably more appropriately, I should have titled the talk Molecular Options for Investigating the Cause of AHPNS. So how do we go about doing that at molecular level? Whatever clues we can use to decide an approach. So what's known about if you know about the virus type with respect to growth signs or histopathology or virion or nucleocapsid morphology, you can then use that to take an educated guess. With those educated guesses, you can use sequence-assisted genome amplification methods. These rely usually on PCR using degenerate primers targeted to functional motifs of proteins that are highly conserved across related viruses. So if you've got a structure of a rhabdovirus, for example, you could do alignments of rhabdovirus proteins with conserved motifs and design PCR primers to those to use to try and amplify a region of the unknown virus. There's other viruses which have got multi-segmented genomes, for example, and they've got highly conserved sequences at the end of those genome segments. So you might be able to design a PCR primer with a terminal sequence targeted to those conserved sequences at the end of the genome segment and use the same kind of approach to generate PCR products which you can clone and sequence. Well, where you have you suspect a viral pathogen but you have few or no obvious clues, then you can't use those kind of approaches. And the kind of approaches then you need to look at, and some of them have been discussed by Tim this morning, are sequence-independent genome amplification methods. And there's a whole range of these, including differential display, subtractive hybridization, random PCR, whole genome amplification, and crude shotgun sequencing approaches like Tim described earlier, looking at ribosomal DNA of bacteria. And there's several others, which I really haven't got time to talk about. I'll just talk about the ones that have got smiley faces there because they're ones that I've had first-hand experience. And the selection adopted really depends on what information you have and what starting material is available. As I said, I'm not going to be able to give a very thorough run-through of those kind of approaches. There's a recent review article here by Ambrose and Cluley that I've got on my USB stick, so if you want a copy that does a probably a lot better job of describing some of these methods than I'll do, see me later on and I can give you a copy of that review. So if we look at a differential display method, it really aims to identify messenger RNA in sample A that's not present in sample B. For example, sample A could be a disease-affected shrimp and you're taking tissue from that. Sample B could be the same tissue taken from a healthy shrimp. It uses primers. These are pieces of sequence or oligonucleotides. They're called primers, and these ones have got an oligo-DT sequence terminated by a specific nucleotide, which will allow you to amplify complementary DNA from a messenger RNA. Once you've made that complementary DNA, you can use short, specific primers like these, which have just got a random sequence. We've just selected some here at random, and you hope that these sequences will recognise very similar sequences and allow you to amplify a piece of DNA. Once you've amplified the DNA, you can separate those pieces of DNA in a gel-based system that separates them on size. You can look to see whether there's differences between the profiles of the DNA bands in the two different samples. You can isolate them, re-amplify them, clone them, and sequence them. This is just an example of a differential display gel, where DNA bands have been resolved based on size, the long ones at the top, the short ones at the bottom. And if I just highlight some bands there, you can see that, for example, here and here, you've got bands in these particular lanes that aren't there. So you've identified something that's unique to that particular sample. I applied this approach in the early days of working with Gill-associated virus. We had a particle morphology of GAV that looked a little bit like a rhabdovirus. We tried a degenerate PCR approach using rhabdovirus targeted sequences, and we couldn't get anything. I applied this approach, and I got a number of clones, which I sequenced, I blasted against the GenBank databases and got nothing back. There was pressure on to keep moving along with the process of discovering what GAV was, and I left them behind. About several years later, I went back and thought, I wonder what those sequences were. After I'd used another approach to determine the genome sequence of GAV, and lo and behold, I did a blast search, and what came up was a complete genome sequence of GAV. And I've just highlighted the two regions there where those two differential display primers bound to. So you can see here, you've got a unique sequence here, the CCCATC, CCCATC here. This is the oligo-DT primer that bound to the poly-A tail of GAV. So indeed, I had a GAV sequence probably 12 months before I actually used another method to get GAV. But there you go. The method worked. There's another method called random PCR. It uses special primers to synthesize cDNA from RNA and then to synthesize second-strand cDNA from that cDNA to give you double-stranded DNA. The kind of primers used here are like this. They've got a universal component that's shared by all of the primers, and they've got variable terminal ends. Either here there's a random position of six nucleotides, or here we're using an oligo-DT sequence anchored to the first position of the RNA before the poly-A tail. So these can be used to make cDNA, and once you've made the cDNA, they can be used to make double-stranded DNA. Once that double-stranded DNA has been made, it can be amplified with the universal primer at the end of those sequences to give you DNA products. This is just a schematic of how the kind of process works. You've got an RNA here. You don't need to know anything about the sequence because the oligo-DT binds to the poly-A. These random ends of each of the primers bind anywhere at multiple positions to make a cDNA strand. Once you've made the cDNA, you can use a Klenau reaction with Klenau DNA polymerase, where these random primers bind in the other direction to make double-stranded DNA. You've now got these terminal universal primers at the end that can use in a PCR reaction to make lots and lots of variable DNA products. Now, when you're doing this kind of approach, you need something that's unique. And with GAV, we're struggling to purify the virus at the time. I looked at total RNA, and what I found in total RNA was a very long band, about 23,000 nucleotides long here. It was resistant to ribonuclease A digestion, and you can see here, after digesting away all of this other RNA, these bands were retained. There's also some other double-stranded RNA bands, which were subgenomic RNAs that we discovered later on for GAV. I also found a band in Gil RNA, which in turned out, in fact, to be DNA. And I used this random PCR approach on this DNA and on this material. And, in fact, this turned out to be a mobile DNA element, similar to a retrotransposon. I was able to purify enough of that long double-stranded RNA to give me starting material to use this procedure. So the procedure was RNase A treat your total RNA to identify this band, to gel purify it, to separate the double-stranded RNA into single strands, make cDNA, make double-stranded DNA, and to use that universal primer to amplify DNA randomly. And you can see here a smear of material on this polyacrylamide gel between about 0.5 kb and about a kilobase long. Once you've got that material, you can clone and sequence it. This is a schematic of just one of the genes of Gil-associated virus. It's a very long gene called RF1A1B. It's about 20,000 nucleotides long. And you can see all the G clones here, or segments that relate to the genome that I've highlighted in blue, came out of that library of clones prepared from that random PCR approach using that 22 kilodalton double-stranded RNA. So we could then fill in spaces by using other kind of molecular methods to derive the complete genome sequence of GAV. And as Tim was mentioning earlier as well, you can apply this approach and essentially take a liquid sample, filter it, either ultracentrifuge it if you need to concentrate it, put it through a 22 micron filter to isolate virions. DNA is treated, RNA is treated if you wish to remove any exogenous DNA or RNA that may be in the sample, and then go through that process I've just described. So rather than using in my case, a piece of RNA that I've gel purified, you can also use filtered material to give you a starting material for this approach. Now, more recently, I've looked at a whole genome amplification strategy. In this case, looking at an abalone herpes virus, which causes a disease called abalone viral ganglioneuritis, AVG. In this case, it's very difficult to get large amounts of purified viral material because you're starting with nerve tissues of abalone to get a starting material to purify your virus. So really, the method I used here was to extract some nerve tissue from the abalone, homogenise, sonicate, clarify that to get rid of most of the big material and leave mainly viral material behind, semi-purify it by ultracentrifugation, extract DNA, and then you've got a very small amount of DNA. What do you do with that? It's hard to do anything with it unless you amplify it. And this is where you can use whole genome amplification to get a lot of DNA from not very much. And then use, as Tim described earlier, one of the next-gen sequencing platforms to generate a lot of sequence of that particular DNA. And then, as Tim said, you need bioinformatics help to assemble all of that information into something useful. These are bits of abalone muscle. So you can see the kind of starting material you might use for this process. Bits of muscle here with nerves where I could scrape out nerves. Homogenise, sonicate, clarify, and run it through a sucrose density gradient to get bands of an approximate buoyant density that you might expect for a virus. I've just highlighted two here that I concentrated on. And the thing about this whole genome amplification approach, it uses this enzyme called Phi-29 DNA polymerase. It's sold as Repli-G by Qiagen. It uses a very simple strategy of taking your semi-purified genomic DNA, denaturing it, for a few minutes at room temperature, neutralising the buffer, and then just using a crude master mix that's got the enzyme and nucleotides need to make DNA, incubate it at 30 degrees for maybe overnight, and you've got your amplified DNA. And the amazing thing about this multiple displacement amplification strategy, it doesn't really matter how much DNA you start with. For example, you can have 0.1 of a nanogram to 100 nanogram, incubate it, and by 7 hours you can have 40 micrograms of DNA that's representational of that DNA. So you can start with a fly speck and end up with a bucketful. This is what the DNA looks like. Not only is it representational of your whatever you started with, I've run an agarose gel here, you can see it's very long. And of course, abalone herpes virus, being a herpes virus, has got a very long genome. We expected it to be about 200 kilodaltons long, so it was nice to see that we could amplify bits of DNA over 30 kilodaltons long, kilobases long. Now, one of the interesting things we found about this Repli-G system, this multiple displacement amplification system, these are some real-time PCR tests where I'm looking at CT values. A lower value means more DNA, a larger value means less DNA. If we just concentrate on sample 7, with a test for the abalone herpes virus DNA, you can see a CT of 23. After Repli-G amplification, a CT of 16. So we've increased that by about 6 or 7 CT values, which is about over 100-fold. With respect to the 18S ribosomal DNA, we had more template here than ABHV template. After Repli-G amplification, the CT value is now shifted to be much higher, which is a differential of about 9 CT values, which is about 1,000-fold. So if you look at the combined difference here compared to before Repli-G and after Repli-G, you've now got a differential, if you add those two together, of over 15 CT values, and that equates to about a 50,000 to 100,000-fold enrichment for viral DNA. Now, these are just... I'm mostly working for one of the companies here because these are just some photos of the next-gen sequencing platform instrumentation. We actually ran our sequences through the Roche 454 Pyro sequencing machine. We also undertook some Illumina next-gen analyses as well of a different strain. And there's another machine sold by Life Technologies, Iron Torrent. using iron torrent technology. So there's lots of these platforms available now for generating masses of sequence. This is the kind of information that comes out of them. In fact, this is the already assembled information, not the raw data. And, in fact, this was the material I showed you there for the abalone herpesvirus strain. We ended up with about, I think, about 80-odd long contigs. Some of these sequences here extend over 50,000 nucleotides out that direction, so over to the car park or somewhere over there. And, in fact, it was quite amazing that out of these 80 sequences, all of them were abalone herpesvirus. The half a dozen or so that weren't turned out to be other viruses, novel genomes, circovirus, nanovirus-like genomes. So in the process of trying to purify abalone herpesvirus, I'd co-purified other viruses which were found in this massive sequence. I found no sequences to the abalone genome. None of them were the host. They're all viral of one kind. So it's an amazing capability to have this next-gen sequence process. Bioinformatics can see where those contigs overlap each other, and they can be assembled into a sequence. And I won't describe this. This is three strains of abalone herpesvirus. I undertook purification and sequence analysis of these two. There was some data already available for another one, and by combining all of the sequencing data for those three strains, we're able to deduce what's a quite complicated genome structure here for ABHV, because herpesvirus genome structures are quite complex. I won't go into the details, but you can see here, if you look at the total length of these three abalone herpesvirus strains, they're all unique. They're quite different to an oyster herpesvirus. You can undertake whole genome sequence comparisons of those sequences. If you look at TAS2 strain here, which is the shorter one, based on length, you can see regions here in TAS1 that aren't present in TAS2, and regions here in this Vic isolate that also aren't present in TAS2. So you can zoom in on this sequence comparisons and design all kinds of tests for epidemiology to track strain variations or whatever. And we've since used methods like that now to identify three new strains of abalone herpesvirus in Tasmania. So that's TAS3, TAS4, TAS5. So just to summarise, there are a lot of molecular options out there for investigating involvement of viruses or other pathogens involved in AHPNS. What kind of approaches might be used will be dependent on whatever clues surface from this meeting or down the track. Shotgun sequencing approaches, as Tim mentioned, using these next-gen sequencing platforms, they can be easily done with crude material, and as I said, Tim has already had a bit of a look at that at Centex. But there's other sequence independent approaches. If you want to take those, they'll need some form of pathogen enrichment or purification strategy. If not the pathogen, then look for the nucleic acid of a pathogen, as I just showed you can do, to enrich, purify and amplify that, which in turn will dictate or direct what kind of sequencing strategy you might want to undertake. So with that, I'd just like to thank Drs. Aknath and Mohan for inviting me and for organising for me to attend the meeting, and for Ingo Ernst at DAF for helping support me be here. And I'll leave it there. Thank you.